Hey guys, this is Jennifer with the Shooter's Mindset, and we are live with episode 426. I'm laughing because the boys were making fun of me right before we went live about how I start the show every week. It's not funny. Now I can't keep a straight face. Anyway, the clowns of the hour, we've got Greg Cannon. How's it going?
Fantastic.
And Corey, how's it going?
Oh, just removing spam calls from my phone. Pretty good. Got a couple matches for you, Jen.
How many?
Three.
Very fun, very fun. He's always shooting lots of matches every weekend. And our guest of the hour is none other than the AG Cup champion, Andy Slade. How's it going, Andy?
Hey, guys.
Hey.
That was going back to making fun of Jennifer.
When I see y'all again, I'm going to punch all of y'all.
It's going really good, guys. Thank you for having me on tonight. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. So for anybody that doesn't know you, you know, I want you to introduce yourself, and you're a little richer now. So introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into shooting and some of your accomplishments.
Sure. I'll try to make this fast. I didn't like write out a bio, which maybe would have helped. But basically, I started shooting at a young age. I was a country boy that would go hunting with my dad, and I would take a 22 rifle and shoot glass bottles and, you know, hang out and go squirrel hunting and stuff. And then when 9/11 happened, and, you know, I got out of high school and started working and everything, and one of my friends got blown up in Afghanistan, I decided to go join the Marine Corps, and that's kind of where my shooting became a profession there. And I was a combat engineer in the Marine Corps and a marksmanship instructor for my unit. And then as I progressed through the different shooting sports and all that on my own time, I was asked to come shoot for the Marine Corps Reserve shooting team. And anyway, a lot of fun experiences from that. And then went on into the PRS thing and a lot of the different sniper matches and all that. So anyway, I enjoy a lot of the different shooting sports. I do the rimfire, the sniper matches, PRS, basically anything with a rifle and a scope.
That's, you can shoot just anything in any caliber. We were just kind of talking about that, the different calibers and all that. But what, also tell us what you do in the industry now.
Sure. So I work for, do a bunch of different stuff. So anybody that's ever been in this industry will tell you that the best way to be a millionaire is to start with two. And anyway, I take a bunch of different small pieces and put them into together to make a puzzle. So I own a gun shop and I do training full time for different people. And so we teach people how to perfect a process so that they can realize some results on their own. And then we also work for MDT doing marketing and sales and some different stuff for them and product development and stuff. So anyway, it's all just part of it. And I love every piece of it, and it all comes together. And my wife, you know, she runs the gun shop about full time while I'm out traveling, shooting matches. And it's a interesting lifestyle, but it's definitely one that I really enjoy.
That's awesome that you get to do all of those things that you love. I know it wasn't always that. I know you had a real day job, as you would say, before 2020. I know. So it's kind of interesting how it's kind of warped, and now you can do all these fun things that you enjoy doing and that you're good at. So
yeah, I believe God opens doors for you when you stand up for what you believe in, you know. And man, it was interesting, the whole COVID thing happened, and we've talked about it before on the show, but I ended up losing my job because I wouldn't wear a mask in You know, they were talking about vaccines, and I didn't want to be a part of that. And there's nothing against anybody that wanted to do that. It was just I didn't feel like I should be forced to. And I was working by myself in a shop with a 16-foot bay door open, and for some reason, it was very important to them that I put a mask on. And anyway, they ended up firing me over, and now we're blessed to be able to represent really good companies and kind of do a few of my own things and live a life that allows me to spend more time with my kids and travel around the world and shoot a rifle for a living.
That's awesome.
I make that
the
trade
whole,
any day of the week.
Yeah, really. So the whole reason that we have you on is because you were the champion. You took the AG Cup home. So tell us a little bit about, I know this was your first AG Cup. Tell us a little bit about what your expectations were going into it. And I'm sure that I know the answer to this, but what was your goal going into it?
Yeah. Funny enough, I really didn't know what to expect other than Keith Baker is one of my really good friends, as most of you guys know, and he's shot it a bunch of times. So all I had was what he was telling me. And really all he was telling me was you weren't going to be able to talk to anybody. As far as strategy goes, you're not going to be able to rely on anybody as far as gear, and the targets are going to be really small. And we knew that the venue was different than it had been in the past, and nobody really knew what to expect from that. I had shot at the venue one other time about a year ago. They had a sniper match there called Snipers Unknown, and I was fortunate enough to win that as well. But this match was completely different, and they ended up having the day three in a spot that I didn't even know existed. So I don't think anybody had ever shot a rifle where the day three was. So it was really neat. As far as goals go, I really went there to win. I did not, I don't think I like had that written out. I did some of my other goals, but not going there to try to, you know, just, man, I'm glad I'm here kind of thing. It was more of, I'm going to run this process and try to execute it to the best of my ability. And I knew that if I did that every single stage and I only worried about the mechanics of the process, that it would work. And it turned out that it did. And that's not to say that somebody else couldn't have a better day. I mean, it can always happen because I can't control how somebody else shoots, but that was really the goal, was to execute a perfect process and have as few mistakes as possible along the way.
I think your personality is very, I'm just glad I'm here. I think your personality is, I'm going to win this match every time you go.
Oh, did you do anything different to practice for the match? Anything different in training? And you also own a training company, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What is that again? The training company?
So Rifleman's Path is my training company. So if you look up, we're trying to basically create the Rifleman's brand. So Rifleman's Path is the training company, and then Rifleman's Outfitter is the store. So the question was, did I do anything different to train? I didn't. I think if I was going into it again, I probably would change how I trained a little bit. And when I say that, I mean, every time I have ever really seriously sat down and tried to figure out like economy of motion and really hammer speed was for the PRS Barricade.
Okay.
And there was $30,000 on the line for stage wins, and I only actually won one stage out of the whole weekend.
Yeah,
so
that's normal for, I guess, winning a match though.
It's kind of funny, right? So I think that maybe I would have focused on, if because I had never shot it, right? I probably now that I know what the match looks like, I probably would have focused a little bit more on economy of motion. And I wouldn't have went faster than I did. I maybe would have have been a little bit more efficient, if that
Right.
answers your question.
Yeah, no, definitely. So I guess my comment about that's normal is in my, I guess, sports and USPSA and things like three gun and stuff, it's very rare to see a guy win 5, 6, 7, 8 stages out of a 10 stage match. It can happen, but usually what you're seeing is a guy win one, be second or third, and second or third, and second or third, and then maybe pick up another one. But that consistency over all of the stages is usually what's more important. So kind of backing up, when you're training, how do you break down what you do? Do you do it per week? Do you do it per day? Do you just go out in the backfield and just hammer some targets? Like, how do you set up your training?
That's a great question. And it's funny that very few people actually ask that question. So that's a good one. Take training very seriously, especially for my clients, and we always start with fundamentals. And until you can execute the process perfectly, there's no use in trying to do anything else. And what I mean by the process is being able to understand and actually like lay out what are the fundamentals of marksmanship. So for me, that's breathing, relaxation, natural point of aim, sight alignment, sight picture, trigger control, and follow through. So we need to be able to go into each one of those and break each one down and explain what that means and how do you apply that in real time. From
is
there,
that dry fire or is that live fire for everything?
You can absolutely do every piece of that dry fire until you get the basics.
Okay.
So when we're looking at that, it's okay. When we're talking about breathing, are you breathing out and executing your shot at your natural respiratory pause? Are you breathing properly between positions, that kind of thing.
Okay.
So, and then we can do all of that incrementally as we go.
Gotcha. And do you set a training schedule? Like, do you have a match, let's call it 3 months out, that you work towards and build a program in weekly or monthly increments? Or do you work on something that your previous match you had struggled with?
That's a good question too. What I want to do is, for my personal stuff, I want to look at where do I have deficiencies. So I will go through my last few matches and I will use the fundamentals and I will use my shot process to figure out where did I deviate from that process or where did I deviate from the fundamentals and what caused those misses or why was I able to hit more this weekend than I was able to hit the last time. So what I will do then is, like, a lot of it starts from the notes that you take while you're at the match. So if you're already an advanced level shooter, a lot of your forward momentum is going to come from the notes that you take during a match. So
yes,
like, for example,
absolutely.
So like, for example, one of the takeaways that I had from the AG Cup was making sure that I was able to set up a tripod tack table at various angles of fire. So not only, you know, we tend to practice it on a flat range, but can we get those angles of fire when they're up on a ridge or down in a ravine or down in a hollow? So anyway, point being, it's important to take notes if you're at a match, but until you're at the level to where you're regularly finishing, I'd say in the top 20%, like, you really just need to go back to the fundamentals and go slow.
Right.
Like, don't worry about going fast in your training. Like, speed comes through economy of motion. Economy of motion comes through understanding the process. And once you understand the process, you can execute it more quickly. And then we can find efficiency in that by looking at it and figuring out how to take less steps. So anyway, it's very important. Like, I can't stress that enough, to make sure that you really understand the fundamentals of marksmanship and you have a process. And by process, I mean, can you tell me what you do every single shot? And are you actually executing that every single shot?
Right.
So like, my process for me is, I go to anchor point, look over top of the scope, my hand goes to the bolt, I close the bolt, go to index, I check my level, and then I feel the trigger, press the trigger, pin the trigger every single shot. And then by doing that follow through, I know where the shot went and I know what to correct for. And I ask myself, what does that mean? So if you see the shot go 3/10 right, okay, that's cool. Most people would just adjust 3/10 left and send the next round. But
no,
it's really
no.
it's really important to know why it went 3/10 right and what that means for the next target or the next
Right.
direction of fire and so on.
Yeah, I really like what you said about taking notes from multiple matches and trying to find patterns of improvement, because I think anyone can go out and have a bad stage and not see something that they should have seen. And that's not something that you can necessarily practice to improve, where if consistently you can't do a certain skill, like deploying a tack table or using a rear tripod, if that just eats your lunch, that's consistently points that you're leaving on the table. And I like that analytical approach of really finding match to match to match, what do I need to work on the most?
Yeah. And it's okay if it's that you didn't see the shot. That's good intel. It's good information. Because there's actually, like, we teach a pretty solid plan for what to do when that happens. So
right.
What I want to know is not that you didn't see it. It's that you executed the correction for that, which for us is, you know, you go to fundamentals, do a quick fundamental check. If you can't find anything directly related to fundamentals, you leave it, go to trajectory, look at your elevation turret, make sure it matches your wind card. As long
yep.
as your elevation turret matches the wind card, then you go right to wind and you make a bold correction and you send the next round, because that's exactly what you have to do. Like, you can't just sit there and say, man, I wish I knew where that went. And you can't send the round in the same place.
Right,
so,
'cause that didn't work.
So many people do, though. They just send the next round and they only adjust 1/10. And it's like, man, you gotta be bold with it. Even if the target's only 3/10 wide, man, like, make a 2/10 correction. It's gonna pay dividends in the end.
Yeah. Was winning the AG Cup training for Mammoth?
I mean, I guess anytime you're shooting a rifle, it is, right? But I didn't specifically go there saying, man, I'm training for Mammoth. Let me go to the AG
Okay.
Cup, you know.
And you are
I saw...
wearing the belt, right? All of Mammoth, you're wearing that belt.
Oh, man. That would be fun. We'll have to see.
All right.
So, you know, they have a belt at Mammoth.
Yeah, I know. I think it's kind of how you should do it. Like, if you've got one, you should wear it, win the next one, and keep wearing it. Just keep the joke going.
Yeah. So would I have to wear two in that case? Because
absolutely.
I've won a Mammoth belt before too. So
so the first belt buckle I won when I shot VRS, I wore it to the very next match. And it was uncomfortable as all get out. Yeah. I think you should.
Definitely. So we've kind of touched on your training, or your training company. Let's talk a little bit more about that. So, like, let's say that I suck at shooting, which I do, and I'm like, I need to go see Andy. What would this class be like? Or do you do group sessions, individual sessions?
Mm-hmm. So what we've executed in the past is individual one-on-one training almost every day last year and the year before. So we've been doing this almost 2 years. And I wouldn't say every day. I would say like 3 days a week is probably, because a lot of times I'm traveling to a match or traveling home from a match. But very regularly, we're doing one-on-one training. That is awesome, and it's my favorite way to do this, but I'm going to have to make some changes just because of, like, the chaos that is my life right now. And what I mean by that is, like, it's awesome, and I wouldn't trade it, but, you know, I've got the gun store going on and the training business and everything that I do for MDT and all the matches that I shoot. there's just not enough hours in the day. So what I'm going to do is consolidate that into small group classes. And I don't think it's going to hurt the quality of instruction. If anything, in some testing that I've done it with like four-man group classes, I think it actually helps because guys will ask questions that the others didn't think of, and they get to see me position the other shooters where they kind of get to be like 10,000 foot view, and they don't get that when it's just them by themselves. So this coming year, we're going to dive more into that. And what that'll do is allow me to have less physical training days on the range and allow me to spend a little bit more time in some other areas that I need to pay a little bit more attention to, like my family. And I don't think anybody is going to suffer from it, if that answers your question.
Yeah, I think group training sessions are definitely value add, because for all the reasons that you said, like, I might be thinking about, you know, let's say we're just trying to take a prone shot. I'd maybe focus so much on getting my rifle level and not even thinking about my feet, and they just happen to fall in the right place. But then Jen could be struggling with where her feet are supposed to be. And I hear you say, like, oh, make sure you always put your feet like this, whereas I just put mine like that just out of default. So I think that'll be really good.
Yeah. So typically our classes, you ask what they look like. Normally, if we're doing the standard class, and people should not look at this like, I want to go to Andy's advanced level class, because the secret to all this is it's all fundamentals. Like, if you are not executing the fundamentals well, you're not going to perform well. And man, like, I can show you some cool stuff, but most people come to me and they're like, man, I really need to work on wind, and that's my biggest thing. And it's like, okay, well, is your rifle level every single shot, and do you know exactly where you held your reticle every single shot? And, you know, so there's some things that go into being a good wind shooter that mean you have to have a good baseline. And if you don't have a good baseline from a stable standard level rifle position, you're never going to be good at shooting in the wind. So my classes typically are just really heavy on fundamentals. You'll come and we'll go through them, and then we'll go through the Kestrel one end to the other, and we'll talk about every function in it and what it does and how it applies and what I use and what I don't use. And keep in mind, we're all students of this game, and there's nothing I consider right or wrong. It's just what I do that works for me, right? So, like, people, I'm very patient with people, and a lot of times I love seeing what students do because I can learn from them too. But my intent is to bring you up to my level and show you what I do, and then hopefully you can learn from that. So anyway, we're going through the fundamentals. We're going through the Kestrel from one end to the other. We do a rifle setup. We make sure the body position's right. We check zero. We go do a wind class up on top of the hill, so we get a lot of different directions of fire and hopefully different wind angles, which we normally do. And then once we shoot all those different wind angles in the prone, we'll go ahead and go into positional shooting. And I recommend coming to more than one day, because that's just a lot of information in one day. So moving into the new year, like I was talking about, these group classes, we're going to try to do four-man group classes 2 days and just run those cycles regularly. The second day is almost all positional and execution of stage process. But, you know, everybody that comes there is taught how to correct for, you know, a miss. If you see it, how to measure that and apply it. What do you do if you don't see it? How do you apply a correction? What, how much correction, you know, and just go through shot by shot and figure out what you're doing correctly and what you need some work on. And we kind of fix all that for you.
Yeah. You touched on something really important about going to a group class. For people that aren't used to shooting all day and taking instruction all day, it can be a lot, and drinking through a fire hose doesn't work for everyone. It hardly works for anyone. So by splitting up what you teach each person, you teach the low-hanging fruit, they have time to absorb that and think about it. And I do really think that four-person size is just about perfect. Having taken a lot of classes before, it works really well.
Absolutely. I'm excited about it, and we've done a few as like a beta test type of thing, but anyway, we'll get there and see how it goes, and hopefully it goes really well. But I think everybody's going to benefit from it, and it'll be good.
You have dates yet?
I don't. They'll be coming out
Okay.
soon. I need to get Josh is figuring out the match schedule for 24 at Pig River. And then I'm also going to try to get some classes in. I talked to the guys at Clinton House while I was down there. They said I was welcome there. So
Cool.
anyway, I kind of want to bounce around a few different places in the country, and anywhere that I go shoot a match, I'm going to ask if, you know, we can maybe stay after the match and do a class so that we kind of maximize our travel time.
Oh, nice.
That'd be real smart.
You shooting April with us?
Where at?
Best in Texas, Texas.
And that's in April?
Last
More than
weekend.
likely.
All right. We'll talk later about doing some promotion on your class.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah.
So do you do center fire training, rim fire training, or both?
Both. And honestly, they're very similar. A lot of people try to make out like they're not the same. So I was able to win the Rimfire finale this year, and that was
Congrats.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So I shot four Rimfire matches last year. I think they're very similar. And when I say that, I shot five. There were three one days and then the regional and then the finale. So I shot five total, where a lot of people shoot a whole series, right? Now I shot a ton of matches. I shot a ton of center fire matches, but as far as rim fire goes, there were those five, and I was able to win all of them but one. And the fundamentals are the fundamentals. I shoot a rim fire rifle exactly the same as I shoot a center fire rifle, and it's very important to me that I do that, because you can get lazy with a rim fire and it still reward you versus with a center fire, it'll exploit you. So it's fun going back and forth to make sure that you keep your skills sharp. I think there's a ton to learn from rimfire, especially corrections and like process. It's better than dry fire because it allows you to do the corrections. And man, it's
you
the
get
same
feedback.
thing. It's a lot of fun. Yeah, it's great. Like you go and you feel like you're at a center fire match. You don't have to wear your pro. You don't have to pick up brass. You don't have to reload ammo. Man, it's all the benefits. If we could have an AG cup for rimfire, I'd just probably quit the center fire.
Yeah. And one thing about learning with rimfire, if you think it's easy to shoot rimfire, shoot it with a twitchy fishtailing tailwind and tell me how easy that is.
Yep.
So I'm going to hit a couple of lives real quick. First, when you were talking about process, Keith Baker said that Andy is the master of process. And then Mike Sexton from Clinton House, big shout out to Mike and all of the crew out there. I was at the range a month ago and asked to see the stages that we shot on Sunday. They weren't a thing a month ago. So they've done some real, real serious work out there. But Mike asks, he said, "Hey, I just joined in. Ask Andy, did the 6.5 provide an advantage over the 6mm with the wind on Sunday?"
Ooh, that's a great question. Yes, 100%. But all right, so there's the math on paper, there's the real world application of it, and then there's like the execution of it with the shooter, right? So the math on paper says yes, it absolutely gives you an advantage. I was running a G7 BC at 3.55. I was running a 153.5 Berger, a 105 Berger hybrid out of a 6mm is a 273 G7. So just in ballistics, like you can see right there, a 273 versus a 355 in a wind condition is going to give you an advantage. Now, the bigger advantage that's not on paper is the energy on the steel. and being able to see what happened if you hit right of center or left of center, and being able to make those small corrections. I'm able to do that better with a 6.5 than I am a 6mm, just because of the sheer energy of the bullet on the target. So you're going from 105 grain bullet to 155 grain bullet. It's just, you know, a massive difference. So not only that, but, you know, the time of flight is pretty interesting. So it's going 2680 versus about 2840. So in a Dasher. So yeah. if we're looking at 2840 feet a second flight time versus 2680 flight time, it takes longer for that bullet to get there, which gives you more time to recover from recoil and more time to recover from blast. Think about what's going on, which for me helps a lot because of the, you know, with the some of the stuff I did in the past with explosives and stuff, I don't think my brain probably works quite as well as some people's anymore. But being able to really think about what's going on and have a little bit more time definitely helps. Now, the downside, there's a lot more recoil. With mass comes more recoil, so equal and opposite reaction kind of thing, right? A lot of shooters don't shoot better with a 6.5. You will not automatically shoot better just because the ballistics say you should. Most people will shoot better with a Dasher than they will with a 6.5 Creed or 25 Creed or 25-47 or any of those, because you have to have perfect fundamental, or at least good fundamentals, in order not to have that cartridge exploit you through recoil and you're not able to see as many hits and not be able to correct your misses. So you have to be at a certain point to where you can take advantage of it and it not actually hurt you. I've seen a lot of guys that tried it, worked for them, they had to go back to a Dasher. So anyway, it's not to say that, you know, I'm not saying that to blow my own, toot my own horn or anything like that. It's just that in me training other guys, I see it over and over, you know, like it's a real thing for recoil control and being able to really control that rifle. And unfortunately, controlling a rifle doesn't come from your muscles. It comes from a really well-built position. So a lot of people think that, I need to be able to grip the rifle tighter and squeeze it tighter and drive it. You hear that term, drive the rifle. That really doesn't, that's not how it works. You need to be square with the rifle, and the rifle needs to be coming straight back into your body, and that position needs to be perfect so that the rifle does come straight back and settle down, and then you're able to see what happens versus jumping left or right.
Do you think there's a size limit as far as what type of shooter could shoot that? And I'm thinking more of like really small stature shooters.
That's a good question. So I've got kids, and my daughter Jaden is obviously, you know, she went to Italy and did the whole 22 thing. And I don't let her shoot center fire a lot, but she wanted to shoot a center fire match last year and she was really excited about it. So I just had some factory ammo for my 6.5 and I'm like, you know what, go have fun. And because of her fundamentals and how we've just drilled that over and over and over and over, again, she's super square. The rifle's adjusted for her. It's short enough. She's not having to blade her body out to reach the front of the bag.
Big issue.
She had no problem. Yeah, awesome. She had almost no issue at all. And she's 100 pounds. You know, she's 13.
Yeah. Yeah, she's not big.
Mm-mm. Hey, I heard that your ammo was loaded with love.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I don't keep it a secret. I have a very expensive reloading piece of equipment, and very few people out there could afford it. So my family is awesome, and they're all bought into this thing that we're doing. And my wife is amazing in that she loads every single round that I shoot, and that's a lot of ammo. And she will just grind it out, and she's better at turning her brain off and not thinking about it and just going and Anyway, so yeah, she does every part of it. She lubes it, sizes it, primes it, anneals it, like the whole deal, and charges the powder charges and seats the bullets, and all I have to do is go take off.
You can make a business out of that.
I'm about to say, next week we're going to see on her Facebook page, AG Cup winning 6.5 Creedmoor for sale.
Yeah. Man, I don't know that she is one of those people that is already doing so much. You know, we've got four kids. She's homeschooling them. We've got the gun shop that she's running almost full time because I'm almost never here. And then, you know, she's loading ammo for me. And it's crazy the amount of work that she puts in, and I'm just over the moon happy with her and how she does everything, and could not ask any more of her, but somehow or another she ends up doing it, and I don't even know how to explain that. But
so, just so you know, I wasn't laughing at you when you were talking. I was laughing at Scott Whitehead's comment. He said, Tammy's say? Ammo Company, better watch out, Clay. Josh wants to know what's going on with the giant war whistle behind your head.
That is one of the Wuhan war whistles right there, baby. That's one of two that will be going in the S10 here very soon. So it's going to be a drag and drive truck with an LS and a 9-inch and a couple of Chinese whirly birds on a 6.0, and we're going to see if we can run 850s and have a good time with it.
That could be a real fun ride to a match.
That's an expensive hobby.
You know, I just need something every now and then to there's a couple components to that. One is just the adrenaline of doing something crazy. You know, I mean, the military life and then everything from, you know, I've done all kinds of racing and stuff growing up, and I've had fast cars and all that kind of stuff. And it's just something for me to do that I can go and get my mind off of work for a little bit. Cause I would not change a thing. You hear people say, never turn your hobby into a job. I don't believe that for a minute. Like everybody out there listening, everybody out there listening to this, those people have never had a good life. So,
do it as soon as you can.
Yes, absolutely. Go and do what you love. But there needs to be something that you can do to release from your day-to-day. And it's not that I dislike guns and long-range shooting any more than I used to. It's just I just need to get away sometimes. So the drag racing thing for me right now is kind of where I'm at, that's allowing me to be creative and do something that's a little outside of my day-to-day life and get that adrenaline rush. And this car should run, you know, faster than anything I've ever had. And it's still not crazy fast in the grand scheme of things, but 850 in the quarter is a pretty cool goal. And I'm going to try to have the car running 850s. It's completely apart right now. It's never run before. It's a stock S10 that I'm pulling all apart, and my goal is to have it running in 4 months, making passes. So I don't know. We'll see.
Well, I mean, you got a little extra change now to help.
I remember that wife I told you about.
You're having to pay for all that ammo now.
Right.
That's saying she also does the checkbook.
Yeah. Right. So when I got home, I just handed the check to her.
That's right.
Smart man.
All right. So we're about at the midpoint of the show. Remember, if you're watching us live on Facebook, ask any questions you may have in the comment section of the video. We'll ask it live on air. Other ways to catch us, you know, is check back on the Shooter's Mindset Facebook page. The videos stay up there forever. And we usually upload to all the podcast apps the night after the show. Then finally, everything eventually ends up on the Shooter's Mindset YouTube page. So that's a great place to look up past episodes. And I got one more live question also. Dylan asked, what was your biggest stress when you were going into the AG Cup?
For me, ammo is always a huge stress, and it's not not that my wife doesn't do a good job with it. It's just there's a lot of ammo to load. Like the AG Cup, you needed 350 rounds for competition, and then you needed some rounds to be able to check your dope and clean your barrel and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So if anybody's ever loaded 400 rounds of ammo and did anything else with their life, like there's that's a big time commitment. And just I stress out about making sure that the ammo is right and making sure that it's shooting good. And because, man, all it takes at a match like that is for it to be a little off, something not, you know, something's a little wrong. And the next thing you know, you blow your whole opportunity. So for me, that's definitely always my biggest stress going into a match is the ammo loaded in the right node or in the right seat and depth or whatever. And again, maybe it's my ignorance on a lot of that, because I'm not what I would consider a professional reloader. Obviously my ammo shoots good and Tammy does a good job with it, but I think there's just so many factors that we don't understand. I mean, I could repeat what everybody else says about how to find a good load and how to check it and how to prove it at distance. But man, sometimes I don't know that any of it even matters. It seems like sometimes you do everything right and it shoots great for 3 weeks and then all of a sudden it doesn't. So, and when I say it doesn't, I mean, it goes from shooting an inch and a half at 600 to 3 inches at 600. I mean, it still shoots good. For most people, it would be better than you would ever need. But I mean, these targets at these matches are getting so small that it's almost impossible to go up there and have ammo that is half minute anymore. It's almost because the targets are like 2/10 on a lot of those. So, you know, if you've got ammo that's in the 1 minute range, then you're already outside of your cone of fire on the target size.
Yeah. Switching gears just a little bit on kind of thinking about the sport as a whole. What do you think the key is to growing the sport? Like, it's nice to have these big matches and these big checks, but is it sustainable, and how do you grow the sport so it is?
Yeah, man, I love 22s for that. And I don't have the answer. I'm not, obviously I'm invested in it and I want to make sure that the sport is growing. But what I'm saying is I just don't know that I have the perfect answer. But what I love about 22s is you can take a guy and say, hey, you know what? Learn one thing. Here's good ammo. Here's Ely Match, or pick whatever ammo you want to say. And it takes one of the components out of it. And that allows them to build good fundamentals. They don't have to have the recoil control down yet. They can really just learn and have a good time. And then I think we need to consider a little bit more of leagues or team competition. Like, not that it should be a team sport, but like being able to have several shooters come together and then they have to have one new shooter in the group in order to compete in that event. Stuff like that I think would be really interesting, and it would probably bring a lot more people into the sport. But the big thing that I do is just, for me right now, is just be open to people. And if they ask me questions, I'm an open book. I tell them exactly what I do and how I do it. And anytime I'm at a match, you know, like I'm constantly fixing people's guns and helping people work on their stuff and answering questions and offering my loaner rifle and, you know, just being, and if everybody's like that, to where when a new guy comes to a match and they feel welcomed, they invite their friends. And I think that's key. So we all need to understand that we're a big part of the future of this sport. That being said, man, I think the checks and the big, you know, the big prize tables and stuff have a place in the longevity of the sport, because when I was younger in the sport and younger in years too, looking at the guys holding the prize rifles over their head, you know, and that's what motivated me. I was like, I want to be that guy. Like a $5,000 rifle for a weekend's worth of work, that sounds like a good turn, you know? And so that's what got me hooked and got me wanting to be a part of this, was not only I wanted to be an asset to my team, and I wanted to make sure that I never let anybody on my team down in the military, but I also wanted to make sure that, you know, if I went to one of these events, man, I had an opportunity to win some of that cool stuff too. That was pretty interesting.
Yeah. I think there's a lot that goes into growth, like you said. But one thing that you said that every person that we have on and every person that's been to a match has always said is you can't hardly go to a match without having someone try to, you know, teach you something, give you a tip, let you use their gear. If you ask to use something, they'll hand you a full mag. So I think that welcoming kind of atmosphere at matches is definitely something that got me to stay.
Absolutely. I think it's really important that we involve kids. If you look at high power or any of the old sports that are dying now, and it's not that I'm not saying that in a derogatory way. Yeah. It's just the truth. If your average age is over 40, then you're probably going the wrong direction. And yeah. I haven't looked at that to see where we're at in the PRS, but and all I mean by that is, like, you've got to be constantly bringing those new kids in, and there's got to be a path for them that they can afford. That's the downside. If we keep going down this boutique, extremely expensive route, like, where do the kids come into that? So, right. And I would love to see, like, a Ruger American class or a CZ class or something like that, where it's kind of like in, you know, sometimes in drag racing, they'll have like a, you have to run this size tire. So it kind of limits everybody or whatever, you know.
Right.
It would be, and we have that to an extent with the production class, but we all know that's kind of gotten out of hand. I mean,
yeah. The sport does it a little weird in production, and I think they could change that up. But I think the bigger point that you made was the scholastic component to it. Steel Challenge has SASP. Obviously, the clay sports have, you know, clay sports in high school, college teams, and SSSF is big there. So I could see that organization building a feeder type competition for high school kids. And I think it's probably the most valuable thing that we can do. 22s would probably definitely be the way there. Probably definitely.
So Liberty University has a PRS NRL team.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great way to start. I think once the colleges, if it catches on at the college level, then the high mm-hmm. schools want to follow so that they can feed the college. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, A&M has a practical shooting sports team. They practice twice a month and then they come out to matches. So
I know a couple of the guys on that team. And they're really good dudes. And I think it's important that we look at that as an industry too. If there's any way that we can, as an industry, support some of that, I think that's where it's at, is really looking at how do we nurture that so that it moves forward, because that's incredibly important. So Tom mentioned the NRA shooting sports. I would love to know what their plan looks like. Cause he was saying, you know, that since NRA high power is kind of on the downswing, they're looking for mm-hmm. ways to, that would be a good way to do it, is kind of establish a college level practical shooting team, you know, to where it was more of a structured deal, kind of like the IPRF or the PRS and all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. Yeah. So the Marine Corps even went completely away from paper shooting now, as far as they're no longer doing the standard, like, three positions, sit in one place, NRA high power mm-hmm. style. So I think we'll definitely continue to see that growth.
Yeah. For anyone, if there is a college team out there or a high school team, their Midway Foundation is probably the most valuable thing that you can get involved with. That's Midway USA, but they have a foundation that supports a ton of college and high school teams.
good to know.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. So at the AG Cup this weekend, y'all shot 30 stages. Which one was your favorite and which one did you hate?
Oof. All right. I know which one I hated for sure. And it ended, it was not actually the match director's fault. It was a good stage, but the prop, so the truck had a bed rail that was, it had a bed cover inside the bed rail, like a plastic bed cover. And then underneath that, the bed rail itself had actually come loose from the welds. And there was no way of knowing that unless you had shot out of the truck before, and nobody had. So, you know, I had shot out of a bunch of trucks. I felt super confident going into the truck that I would be just fine. And then I build my first position and it was just chaos. I mean, the reticles going all over the place and I had nowhere to go. So I really went back to the old, like
the Hyperfire truck.
Yes. wait, no. No, I don't know if it was the, it was on day three and it was parked.
The white truck.
White one?
The white one, yeah.
Okay. Oh, not Mike's old truck.
No, dang. No.
Yeah.
I was trying to figure out which one.
Corey, did you see that Mike's truck will live forever now as a prop at Clinton House?
That truck should live forever at a range. That's been, what, 300,000 miles traveling to ranges?
Mm-hmm.
It deserves to be out in the pasture at a range.
So some of the guys actually picked to shoot off of that with a tack table, and if that was definitely the right call. I didn't pick that position just because I felt super confident going in that I could hit the targets off of a bag, off of the bed rail, and not knowing that that bed rail, the side was so wobbly. That was the right choice for some people, and I wish I had done that. But anyway, my favorite stage, I'll say this. I love that the stages were so consistent. I don't really have a favorite stage because I like every stage to be almost the same as far as the level of difficulty. And I love to test different skills, but I want to make sure that every stage doesn't allow like somebody to get a bad wind condition and it just screw their whole match, you know? So I'm not a fan of like long range stages. I like to kind of mix in those long range targets here and there, but I had a favorite moment in the match. We were shooting a prone troop line and it was six targets and you had to go near to far starting at like 250 yards and it went all the way out to like 900. And then you had to come back and go 250 out to 900 again. And right. We had almost a full value left to right wind. And so we were holding like 0.2 at 300 yards and then like almost a mil at the far. Well, got a timer on my gun and I could hear the timer counting down 5, beep, beep. On the second beep, I shot the next to last target. And everybody's like, oh, there's no way he's done, you know. And in my mind, I'm even thinking there's no way I have enough time to dial, hold up, or shoot that next target. So this was the next to the last stage. I had no idea how close the next guy was behind me. I knew I was leading, but I didn't know how close the next guy was. So I literally just held up a mill, which I didn't even know if that was the right dope. It was a total Hail Mary. Held up a mill, closed the bolt, pulled the trigger, and everybody just went nuts. It was like,
nice.
It was so fast because it was like, boom, boom, beep. And everybody's like, what? Oh man, it was great.
Did you have both shots in the air at the same time?
Say at the same time, but two shots within like 5 seconds.
Oh, that's awesome.
At different ranges, at different targets. Mm-hmm. So, like, within 5 seconds, two shots at two different ranges. Like, it was totally not something I would normally do, but because I had that timer, I knew that I had no other chance but to just try. And I'm the kind of person, when it comes down to something like that, that, like, a shot, hit it if you don't try. So, you might as well just send one.
Might as well go for it. That's fine.
I've got a bunch of lightning questions that I just want you to answer as fast as you can. What action to use? What scope?
Vortex Razor, Gen 3.
Which one? Gen 3?
The Gen 3, yeah.
What break?
The MDT and the APA, depending on what gun. So
Okay.
I use them both. Go ahead, sorry.
Chassis is obviously
ACC
MDT.
Elite.
Okay. Trigger.
Trigger Tech Diamond, Pro Curve.
Pro Curve. Nice. And cartridge.
6.5 Creed, 153 and a
Say it
half.
again. Say it again.
Yeah.
6.5 Creed.
Yeah.
I like it. I just like knowing. I think it's fun.
Well, yeah, and we said this off air, but we can say it on air too. First and second, we're shooting 6.5 Creed.
You want to say it louder for the people in the back? So we're joking, right? Because the whole Pro Series was won by a 6GT, but do you really think it's the cartridge? Yeah.
No. Unless you look at averages, and then I was in second in the Pro Series, so averages would say the 6.5 is better, but whatever.
That's the cool thing about different groups of numbers is you can always turn them whichever way you want to, how you look at it. I think it's a great cartridge. That's what I shot when I first started, and I loved my 6.5. It shot so good, and I'm wanted to try something a little bit less heavy, and I've liked my GT, but I might need to bust that 6.5 out again, especially as my 105s are drying up. I need to find some more. So the big question is, where do you go from here? You won the AG Cup. It's one of the biggest accomplishments in precision rifle shooting. Are you trying to set your goals to be up to the level of Jaden as a world champion?
So this coming year, the way that the scores were recorded for the IPRF and how the selection process went, the team has selected six open shooters, and I did not make that cut. So I will be shooting on the US team for the what they call the limited team, which is going to be 308. So that's going to be one of my primary focuses for this coming year is to try to do well at that, but again, I think fundamentals drive the position, and I don't think that it matters a whole lot what gun you're shooting if you have good fundamentals and if you're doing your job. So, I will not be shooting tactical and the PRS because I don't see that being an advantage to me or my family, but or the companies that I represent, but because I want to go win, right? And why would I put myself at a disadvantage day to day when I feel like I'm going to perform well with it, and I will absolutely put the time in and practice to ensure that. But to answer your question, I want to make sure that I represent the companies that I represent well. I want to make sure that I train people to do what I do and to reach their goals. I want to make sure that the shooting sports in general are healthy. I want to try to spend enough time with my kids and my wife to where we all have a really good life and manage all that as good as I can. So my goals for this coming year are going to be very similar. I want to maintain that top five in the PRS. I want to maintain the top five in the rimfire side, and I want to win that limited class in the IPRF world shoot this year. So that's kind of where I'm at with that. And then while doing those things, not lose the performance that the other like my gun shop or my training business. So all that's a lot to juggle, but that's kind of where I'm at with it.
I will say, speaking of Jaden and being in Italy and winning that junior division, whenever you won Sunday, I saw a lot of the shooters from the IPRF that were like, my friend Andy won because you helped. I mean, you obviously coached Jaden, you were there. You gave her tongue lashing when she wasn't as fast as you wanted, you know, and you motivated her, but you also were there helping all of the shooters, no matter what country they were from. They were coming and asking you questions, you know, how should I do this? And I saw you multiple times giving advice and helping them out, and it meant something to them, because then they, a lot of them watched the footage of the AG Cup, and they were so excited to see that you won because they knew you from Italy. And so it was kind of neat to just see that dynamic and how that went.
It was really cool because I got to go to France when Laurel went. I went as her coach, and then I got to go to Italy with my daughter. So both times I got to meet a lot of the international shooters, and it's, they're the same. They're our people. You know, it's, I think the mentality that brings a person to want to go shoot a rifle match is consistent across the board. So it was super neat, man. Like getting the messages, like I had you in the pool, we won, you know?
Yeah. I know Great Britain watched the footage at their match. That they had a match on Sunday and they took a lunch break and they were watching the footage. So
awesome. How cool is that? It is so cool. Yeah. And, you know, I know that there's guys out there that would love to get training and trying to work through some of that. That would be really cool to be able to go and do some international training. And I've had guys from different countries come here and do training before. So anyway, all that is part of why I love this sport, is being able to just help people and see their growth, see that light bulb go off, and really be able to, you know, take a shooter and immediately change their whole program. And then, you know, there's no magic pill, right? There's no light switch. But that being said, a lot of shooters come to me and then like a week later, they send me match results and they're like, dude, this is the best I've ever finished. And that means a lot to me. It really does, because it shows that all the hours that I put into failing, honestly, meant something to somebody else other than me, you know, because all of that program that I run now is based off of my successes and failures and how to mitigate the risk of doing the things that I, you know, didn't do well. So anyway, it's a lot of fun, and being able to help people with that, especially when they're very receptive, is just a ton of fun.
Do we have any more lives?
John said, Andy is an awesome instructor. Rifleman's path for the win. Chris said, congrats, Andy. Awesome to see a VA good old boy getting it done.
Did anybody notice the Marine Corps hymn playing while the fireworks were going off? I thought that would be a little Army versus Marine Corps touch there.
I did not. I was too busy trying to not get burned. Those things were going, and then all of a sudden they like went even more, and I was like, whoa, what is happening? They were pretty amazing.
I was focused very intently on our Starlink that was about 12 feet to your left.
Yeah, that you didn't want to move. I was like, Greg, you have to move that.
I said, okay, moving that was a really good idea. Thank you.
It was expensive. I was like, we gotta move that thing.
I turned around and looked a couple times. I was like, man, if this beard catches on fire, it's gonna be tragic.
We do not need a Michael Jackson moment. That would be bad.
Oh my gosh, did you guys see the Wind Diaries?
Yes.
Dying laughing. Holy cow.
I love
the work for money.
Or was it We'll Work for Money or We'll Work for Food?
Excellent. Have you seen the one after that?
Oh, with the TV.
Where the right before that one, it was like make no mistake, Happy Gilmore's caddy just won the AG Cup.
Yes,
the beer to do.
That is hilarious.
Wind Call Diaries was awesome all throughout the weekend. I like that they, in their poll results for who's going to win, Andy Will Work for Food Slade. Well, you put in the work and you can get a lot of food with that check you bought home.
I don't know. It sounds like Tammy took the check.
She can buy some food.
All right. Is that all the lives?
Yeah.
That looks like all of them.
All right. I think we can wind it down to shout outs. We will start with drum roll because it makes Corey nervous.
Every time.
I know what I'm going to say. I'm going to say thank you to Vortex Optics for being our title sponsor and letting, you know, helping us get out to the Clinton House and pay for our Starlink and all that good stuff so that we can provide this live coverage to you guys, as well as shout out to Foundation Stocks for their support in this stream as well. And shout out to everybody at Clinton House and everybody that put on the AG Cup, Mike Sexton, the whole Clinton House crew, Tom, Christy, even Haywood. We'll even shout out Haywood.
All right, Corey.
I got an easy one this time. I want to shout out Federal. I got some Black Cloud ammo. I'm going duck and goose hunting this week. It is happening again.
It's happening again. Mm-hmm. All right. How about Andy?
Man, there are so many people that helped me get to this point. It would be really hard for me to put a list out there, but the main ones, MDT, obviously is a huge part of my life and just an awesome company. Lone Peak, Geisley Barrels, the Vortex Optics. Man, I'm going to mess this up. Peterson Brass. If you got, so everybody's always asking, like, how does a 6.5 shoot accurately enough to compete with the Dasher? Buy some Peterson small rifle primer 6.5 brass and just go try it. Like, the stuff is amazing. So that's what I was shooting all weekend, is that 6.5 Peterson small rifle primer with a CCI 450 in it, and it just absolutely crushes. There are so many people that put all the work in for the match, like you said, Tom and Mike and everybody there at the Clinton House, and everybody that was here at home. Like, I couldn't believe, I bet I had hundreds of texts and phone calls from people that wanted to say congratulations and thank you. And everybody that sent me something like that, I just want you to know it meant a whole lot to somebody like me to see people take time out of their day to send that to me. So my wife and kids sitting back home praying something like this could be real. And it actually turned out that it was. So anyway, that's all my shout outs for now. But if I forgot somebody, I'm really sorry. And thank you for everything you do.
That's right. Just cover the blanket. And I just want to shout you out for coming and spending your Tuesday night. I know you've been gone all weekend away from your family. So thank you for taking the time to come and talk to us here. And thank you for everything that you do for the sport, because you have always, I mean, ever since, gosh, I think I met you 5 years ago, something like that. You've always been on fire for the sport and helping grow it and helping others, even before the beard was in existence. I told my husband, I was like, yeah, when I first met Andy, he had no beard. He was like, really? I was like, yeah, baby face, just smooth, nothing. So the beard has come along throughout the years, but you've always had a heart for, you know, helping people get better and grow and, you know, help grow the sport. So thank you for that. And with that, that will be a wrap for episode 426, and we will see everybody next time.